these guys too. Yeah, actually, Caroline's in Charlene's program, and she's working with me this summer on some stuff related to what I'm talking about here. So, just to give you an idea of the kind of projects that we're trying to set up. Am I ready to?
Yes, you're good.
When Jay gives me the thumbs up, I'll go.
All right.
Well, you can see my title here, and obviously, this is the kind of thing that I could spend a semester class talking about. So I'm going to give you kind of this overview. If you read the abstract of what I wrote, that gives you kind of an idea where I'm coming from with this. And, you know, I'm starting with this as sort of a provocative slide here, but unless you've been living in a cave for the last decade or so, you'd be well aware of what passes for debate around this whole climate change business. And I'm not interested in the politics of this at all, really, other than to say, as a paleoclimatologist, they affect me in ways both good and bad. And in the negative side, one of them is obviously there's a lot more heat on us. Funding has become more difficult to get, because particularly in tree rings, because so much of the temperature reconstructions that will be made, some of which I'll show you, are based on tree rings. And often they're based on maybe some dubious applications of our science. And so what I want you to come through this message from someone who's sort of in the front lines of this business as to what's good and bad about this debate. And the good of it is actually that it's given us an opportunity. Anytime you get challenged in any way, what Jay was saying before about challenging your lesson plan, it makes you have to come up with an answer. And when people ask you, you know, what do you think about global warming, rather than just saying I either believe it or I don't believe it, you have information at your hand. And how we go about getting these answers is what I'm kind of hoping to bring. And probably some of you are familiar with some of the techniques like ice core sampling, or in general terms, what it means or how it's done. But there's a lot of this other stuff that I hope to kind of put out there so that you can be more critical when you're looking at data. And rather than just taking someone's word for it that this is a proxy of temperature or a proxy of precipitation, what goes into making it? And the other good part of this, I would say, is that there's a lot more transparency now with what we do in science. There has to be. And there's a couple of things that I don't know how many of you follow the news. Have anyone heard about the Australian paper that had to be pulled, the temperature reconstruction? Anyone, show of hands if you've heard of it. All right. It was a tree ring paper that was done by a woman from Australia, part of this PAGES 2K. Anyone familiar with the Past Global Changes Initiative? All right, I'll give you a little bit of background, and then I'll get on with this, because it's interesting. But PAGES is part of the International Geosphere Biosphere Project, IGBP. And it's funded by NSF and some Swiss groups and everything. And the idea with PAGES is one of the main functionaries is to getting these reconstructions of climate out there that are then used by the IPCC. So you can imagine now the political lightning rod that the IPCC has come, some of it deservedly so, heaped upon themselves. And the Joel Gerges paper is one example of that. And so Joel's paper was the Australian part of looking at the last 2,000 years of temperature change on the planet. And they used some techniques, some of which is REGM method that Mike Mann has used to produce the hockey stick that everyone's definitely heard of, unless you have been living in that imaginary cave I mentioned. And so there's actually some statistical biasing that goes into some of these records. And so there's a lot of things that are real in this, things that we know. And if anyone tells you they can prove that we're warming the planet, they're not being entirely honest with you. But what we can do is we can show you a whole lot of evidence that leads you to the conclusions that you can draw. And when we're trying to be as honest as possible about these things, we produce our data warts and all. And in every proxy source of information that we use, it has its strengths and it has its weaknesses. And I hope to get a little of that across. So what is it that we do know? Well, we know a lot from where we've had instrumentation, which really covers the 20th century, basically, into the part of the 19th century and now into the 21st century. So we can look at things that we do know that we've warmed the planet. Or that, let me back up there. We know that the planet has warmed over the instrumental period, all right? And this is a global average of all of the temperature instrumental records around the world that have been compiled and weighted in various ways. If you've heard of the BEST, B-E-S-T, has anyone heard of that? The Berkeley, I can't remember what it stands for exactly. But it's something out of Berkeley, look it up, B-E-S-T. And that was actually funded in part by the Koch brothers. I'm sure you all know who they are. And so this was actually a funding initiative to look at how the temperature records have been analyzed by climate scientists like myself to see if there was any bias introduced to it. The end result of it was the data have not been treated in any ill way that led to any sort of biasing. And so it doesn't prove anything about global warming, but what it does do is prove that at least the data were analyzed in a way that's commensurate with anything above board. So it's not the hoax in that regard that people want you to believe it is. So you can see that if you look at the scales, I'm always big on this too. I mean, if you put this scale so it only went, you know, it depends on your gradations. You could flatten this thing out so it looked like there's almost no warming or trend. But that's a pretty significant trend as far as global temperatures go. You know, you can see these are in anomaly units. So we've been up about 0.6 degrees since the middle of the 20th century, including this little cool period here. We also know that the Arctic sea ice has been melting, or its aerial extent. You can't see this real well here, but this is the average of 1979 to 2000, and this is what's been happening to it. We can map this in, and we also know from old Navy records of submarines that have been under the ice how thick it was back around the World War II period of time. So there is a substantial amount of data. All of this has been generated from satellite imagery, so it doesn't go back that far, but we know that it's not only been melting, or its aerial extent has been disappearing, but it's thinning as well. And these are things that we can actually measure. So that we can say something about this, right? That what's the effect, and what is the effect of losing this ice up in on the polar ice cap? Well, there's a couple of things. One, you're gonna really drastically alter the salinity of the ocean in the area. This can inhibit deep water formation, which can lead to cooling periods like we had at the Younger Dryas at the beginning of the Holocene. And it can also change the albedo, which means as you get darker water in there, you're absorbing a lot more heat, and this feedback on the system. So these are really significant things that we can look at. We also know that the major ice sheets have been thinning. And here's an example from Greenland. This is actually up to June 26 of this year. And what this is showing here, it's a measure of reflectivity at the highest parts of the ice sheet in Greenland. And so you can see it's not that easy to tell from this, but essentially through the period from 2000 to now, every year we get a little bit deeper into this lower part of this curve. And that albedo is affected by things like standing water on the top of the ice sheet where there used to be snow. The albedo would be higher. And we are actually losing this ice sheet. And so the same thing's happening in parts of Antarctica. Not everywhere, but in parts of Antarctica it's happening too. And of course, this is the thing that we worry about most. The Arctic ice, as far as affecting sea level, would have a minimal impact on that. But this will have significant impacts, and we worry about the base sheets accelerating their movement and then rapidly just entering the ocean and raising sea level in catastrophic ways. So this is one of the things that concerns people quite a great deal. And so we have a couple questions then that those things that I just outlined that we know about the current climate, is it unusual? Is it just part of natural variability? And I travel around the world and I meet people all around who probably watched a little bit too much Fox News, and they will tell me things like the greatest hoax ever perpetrated on mankind. And I hear this all the time. Well, it was warm in the past when the dinosaurs roamed the earth, and we had a medieval warm period and all these things. And that's true. It has been very warm in the past. We've been ice-free on the planet. But the scales of the things that are functioning to cause those warmings in the past are completely different than what we're talking about here. Those are Milankovitch-type cycles where the planet's rotation and its orbit has changed. You're closer to the sun. Solar output's been far greater with respect to what we're absorbing on our planet. We've also had very high CO2 levels in the past for a variety of reasons. That has nothing to do with humans. But in the timescales we're talking about, the things that we've done to our atmosphere are measurable. And this is the salient point to make on this. And the other salient point I'd like to make, it's a little bit of my interest. I'm less concerned about temperature than I am about water distribution on the planet. So one of the things that's happening as we do face the changes that we seem to be occurring or happening to us right now, our water distribution, and it's highly unpredictable. All the GCMs that we use, the last IPCC reiteration, they got it really wrong on water, on rainfall distribution. And that's a tricky thing. So how can we tell if this is if the recent warming that we're seeing is unusual? Well, we can go back to the paleo records and look at these archives. And I show a few of them here, and I'll talk about some of them in detail. And then the other question is, okay, we know that this century has been warm. Is it the warmest of the past millennium when we know we have an analog period in the medieval climate anomaly or the medieval warm period or the medieval climate optimum, whatever you want to call it? They all have their own political charge to each of those expressions. I prefer medieval warm period because that's what I grew up with. And it was warm, but what you see here, this is the nest of a whole bunch of the published reconstructions of climate, and all of them show that the recent warming is not as warm as the medieval warm period. Now, I'm not sure what to make of this because some of the records I've produced from parts of the planet that I've looked at have a very clear medieval warm period that equals what we see now. And so this is where things get interesting to me. And here's where I see opportunity. And if you're going to be criticized on something, well, this could be a statistical artifact by how we treat a tree ring time series. Or maybe because we use Hutton's uniformitarian principle, right? The processes that take place in limited process on the planet today were the same ones that existed in the past. So if trees are limited by moisture today in a certain way, they were limited by moisture in the past. Where it gets tricky is most of these are tree ring based. If not entirely, at least a major proportion of these are based on dendrochronology from around the planet. There's coral records, there's ice core. I believe this is a borehole record. And so what I will say about dendrochronology is trees aren't the best temperature recorder. They can, under the right circumstances, be very reflective of temperature. They're very good moisture responders because no matter what the temperature is doing, the trees don't do anything if they don't have moisture. And one of the questions that I hope to give you some insight into how we're approaching it is how do we know that the medieval warm period where trees are in essence in some parts of the Arctic showing a big major spurt in growth, is that warming? Is that because we know that temperature is not a linear response, it has a curvilinear response in photosynthesis. How do we know that we're not looking at a mixed signal in there? And the fact is, we don't from the way we've presented it currently. But when we look at tree rings, normally we're looking at the ring widths. We measure the amount of growth in a radial direction every year, and that we can put that into terms of basal area increment and mass of the tree. But there's other things we can do in it as well. And I'm going to talk about stable isotope analysis in a minute, particularly for carbon as it applies here. At the end of the talk, that'll come up. But the other thing is X-ray densitometry of wood. Because the thing that is the best indicator of growing season temperature in trees is density, particularly for trees like spruce and larch that grow in the boreal forest zone. Far more sensitive to temperature and more reliable than is ring width, because ring width can be controlled by antecedent conditions from the prior year or years, because trees have memory. Because they retain foliage for several years, they can have what's called autocorrelation or persistence. And when we model these, we typically take that out. And so there's a lot of stuff that we do to produce these reconstructions that are kind of the dirty linen that nobody really wants to talk about. And when it's done poorly, you come out with a lot of things that look like this, the hockey stick. Sometimes I cringe when I see what's being published for political purposes on one side of a debate or another, because as scientists, I believe that we're supposed to let's see what the data show us, and let's do the best we can with it and be as honest as we can with what we're showing. So the next question in the $80 million or $80 trillion question is, are we doing this to the planet? Is this warming related to us? And of course, there's a bunch of things. The two primary natural drivers of forcing of warmth on the planet would be the output of the sun and output of volcanoes, right? So these are two of the natural things that can influence how much heat we're retaining in the planet. And to be honest with you, there's quite a debate about what the response of the volcanic eruptions are, the big dust veil events, particularly the tropical ones. We showed from the work we've done in Vietnam that it actually, where the models were predicting drought, we show a year following these big eruptions in the tropics of being extremely wet in Vietnam. And so this is something that we're just starting to come to grips with. And this is very reliable. We published a paper in 2010 that shows that all the major volcanic eruptions corresponded to very wet conditions the next year, contrary to what all the GCMs were predicting. But they also predict extreme cold up in the high latitudes. And don't get me started on the recent Mike Mann paper. I'll talk about that in a bit. Oh, and then there's greenhouse gases, all right? And I want to talk a little bit about the greenhouse gases, because one thing we know for sure, we can measure this, we've been pumping this stuff into the atmosphere for not very long. It's really about the middle of the 19th century. And here's the black line here is the total that we've been putting in millions of metric tons. And what you can see is that this is a ridiculously rapid rise of old carbon that we've pumped into the atmosphere, to the point that it affects things like radiocarbon dating. We get the Seuss effect from this industrial carbon. This stuff is radiocarbon dead that's up in the atmosphere. So it's affecting measurements we might make. The contribution initially was mostly coal. This green line here is what drives most of it. And there's the line of coal. Here's petroleum or petrol. And then we have natural gas coming in recently. And then this is cement production, because you get old carbon being outgassed from the calcium carbonate in limestone. And so it's old radiocarbon dead, millions of years old carbon. So we're putting all this in the atmosphere, right? And one thing we know about CO2 as a greenhouse, it does help warm the planet. I mean, this is undisputable with the physics. So we know we pumped a lot of it in there. And then what we could do, and I apologize if you can't read this that well, but this is breaks down the different radiative forcing components that we know about in the atmosphere. And one of the criticisms you're going to always get on this is by people on one side of the debate or the other, is saying that when we run our models and we put these things in as we understand them in the physics of our models, that we're biasing our model results because we're putting in the things that we know of in this regard. And let me just explain this a little bit. This is CO2, this is methane and nitrous oxide and halocarbons. And anything that is a red bar here is a net warming gain. It's a net trapping of heat in the atmosphere. And then there are things that we know that either backscatter or through albedo just downright reflect radiation as it comes to the planet. So they have a net effect of cooling. And some of them we don't really understand that well. But as we understand it, and the best we can do with our physics, we can account for an anthropogenic warming of 1.6 watts per meter square currently from what we know about what we're doing in the atmosphere. So this is alarming. We've never seen this before as one species that's influenced our atmosphere in a really profound way. If you go back to that slide, if I can go back to that slide, just this should give anyone pause to see that line. That's just ridiculous. And the idea is how much longer that will continue in that way is what has us wondering how we're going to deal with that, as you'll get to in a minute. So all these things add up to this net warming. And then here's another case of something that I'll show you that, again, could be criticized for potentially biasing the results with models produced by people who are climate scientists, and this is where the criticism comes in. Here's the actual temperatures for the last century from 1900 to 2000. And so this black line, it's the same in both. But we've taken the nest of GCM models and driven this model using only the natural forcing, and it cannot account, I mean, this is major things like volcanic eruptions and the solar forcing that we know about. Running the model with those real inputs in there, you actually get this blue line that shows up here. It's only when you add in what we know about the anthropogenic forcing combined with the natural forcing that we actually match that line. And so this is something that people are using as evidence for showing that we're warming the planet. But the truth of the matter is, I want you to get this in your minds. Model output is not data. It's model output, right? It's not real data. We're not actually measuring anything. We're using a series of equations in a computer program to predict something. And so it can be biased by what you add in there. Nevertheless, there's a lot of minds a lot smarter than mine that go into making these things. And there does seem to be something here. And I find this to be another interesting point to make here. The idea of, okay, let's say, and I don't think this will happen in my lifetime, but let's say people get serious and actually do take, for whatever reason you choose, to stop polluting our atmosphere with the gases that we're putting into the atmosphere. And if we were to stop today and actually reverse, so these are emissions here and projections out into the future. So under the best case scenario, we stop doing everything as we did here. We gradually stop, we go down, or just business as usual at the top line here. how long it's going to remain in our atmosphere at high levels. We're talking, even if we were to stop using fossil fuels today, we're going to still maintain a residual of greater than 450 parts per million in the atmosphere out at least a couple centuries. That's the most radical thing that will never happen. The more likely case is that we're going to continue along our current trajectory, and then some point in the middle of this century, because of what we know about oil reserves and all that, it's likely that we'll peak and that we will, for one reason or another, hit some sort of wall that's going to stop us. And if we trailed off in emissions at that point, we're up to 1,000 parts per million, which we haven't, well, you're going to see in a moment. When did we see that last, all right? So the most conservative of estimates, we're already above what we consider to be that critical threshold that some people put at 350. You could put it at 450 because that's, I think we're about 4-something right now. I forget the exact number. So that's likely to run out into the future for quite a while. So taking what we know in the current state-of-the-art GCMs that a lot of people are going to criticize, but no, they're the best we've got. And this is a whole nest of them here, from the Hadley Centers to CSIROs in Australia. All these different models run with the current, you know, the background conditions to the current time here. And then if we project them forward into the future, the most conservative estimate of warming that we can get is going to be about 2 degrees C. And you remember what I showed you for the last century or so, it's been about 0.6 degrees C. And we're talking a really massive increase in temperature on a global scale. And the median value out of all this mess here, from ranging from 2 up to about 5, is about 3 degrees C. So that's a really large, alarming warning, if you can believe these models. So when was the last time we had CO2 at those levels? You actually have to go back to the Oligocene into the Eocene to get CO2 levels. Now, these are from paleoarchives. I'm going to talk about this in a little while, how we come out with these. But this is long, deep time. This is current time here on this axis, going back in time 30 years, 35 years to this boundary, to the Eocene and to the Oligocene. And what we know about these periods of time was we had very high CO2 relative to today. And then this line is actually taken from benthic foraminifera, from deep ocean cores that are paleothermometer of temperature. And they can show that it was much warmer as we went back here. We know this from the megafauna and fossils that we find in the geologic record. We also know that the Oligocene ended on a very high peak of CO2 and a big mass extinction. I forget what it's called. You'll have to look this up. I have it in the notes on the presentation if anyone's interested. And so we also know that there was no polar ice at the North Pole, but there was at the South Pole. But in the Eocene, there was no ice on the planet. So when we've had CO2 in the past, it's corresponded to these exceptionally warm epochs that we've had. And very often when we had these big changes, big abrupt changes like that, they correspond to these big extinction events. So that's something we do know. All right, so that brings us to looking at proxy sources of climate from these natural archives. And I list 6 of them here. I'm going to talk about everything but coral today because I don't want to take too much of your time. And so, as I mentioned in the abstract, just trying to wax a little poetic on you guys, these are like pages in a book, if you can think of them that way. But all of them have something about them that has to be taken into account. I'll just give you one example here. Ice cores. All right, you think about how ice forms on an ice sheet or on a glacier. It comes as water content of snow, and it sits there until enough weight and pressure has been on it to condense it into ice. So that's going to take some time. And what's that time going to be dependent on? Obviously, the input, how much water content is coming into that, how much weight of water. You know, so your accumulation rates are really important. And how wet it is and what the temperature is as well, whether you're going to compact that into ice. And so this becomes really important in a moment. You'll see this. But among other things, it traps water content, so we can look at the geochemistry of that water to see what its source region was or what its temperature was at the time that it fell. But also we look at a whole bunch of other things in it as well, including the air that gets trapped in it that takes however long it takes to close that into ice. There's a smooth record of trapped gases, or trapped air from the ambient atmosphere that I'll get into in a minute. Tree rings they don't live that long, but they're beautifully represented for annual reproducibility. They're really good for looking at the last couple thousand years. Some of our records go back 10,000 years from piecing living and dead trees together. The corals were our great hope back in the 80s. I remember when this was first coming into play. But they never really panned out to make those kind of... We were really thinking we'd have an oceanic version of tree rings, something that we could get lots of records from, reproduce them, and get these long records. And it was a lot slower to happen than we would have hoped. There's been some great work done by Kim Cobb, who's done some really neat things looking at fossil corals and started to piece together long records that have gaps. But it's never really panned out to what we hoped it would be. The next great thing that we had more recently are the speleothems, stalagmites in caves, and I'll talk about those in a minute. Deep ocean coring, and then coring from bogs. This is Dorothy Petit at the Pyrmont Marsh that some of you may end up going. I think you'll probably end up going there. It's a really cool place. And so all of these proxy sources have something, some constraints on them that everyone needs to know. And one of them is, what's the dating control on it? Well, obviously, in tree rings, you have a dating control, if you do it correctly, of exactly 1 year. And you can get sub-seasonal information on it. But you don't tend to get really long records. Whereas ice cores, you get, in theory, annual laminations. But by the time, what can happen to ice sometimes? It can melt, right? So you could actually have hiatuses where there's ice missing from a record. And that happens. You can find that, so you have these discontinuities. And also what happens to ice as it sits there, it compacts. And so you get these, it squashes the whole record. So there is some sort of smoothing that has to take place to account for that if you're looking at layers. Tree rings have a similar thing of standardization because as just based on geometry of a tree, we have to account for it. If you add the same volume of wood to a cylinder of increasing diameter, you get a negative exponential decay when you plot it on an XY axis. And that's just the constraint of geometry. We have to account for that. That's called the biological growth trend. And all of these records have something like that. Muds will compact. They can have turbidity in them in ocean currents. Things can muddy up the bottom. You get things turned over. Earthquakes can take place and mess things up. All these things have to be tightly constrained. So the dating, the resolution, is it annual? Is it decadal? Is it a century? How much information can I say about something? The deep ocean cores very often go millions of years. But I'm not getting annual records out of them all the time. They're rare to get annual records out of varb sediments in the ocean. Santa Barbara Basin is one. The Cariaco Basin in Venezuela is another. And then what's the variable being measured? And because of the, you know, I don't have too much time to bore you guys today, I'm really going to concentrate on the geochemistry of oxygen, stable isotopes of oxygen, particularly Delo-18. So the 18 oxygen stable isotope. And you know the difference between the stable and the radioactive isotopes, right? The stable, they don't decay, so they'll be fixed in that record. But what happens to them in the water column as they go through, as you're going to see in a moment, from evaporated seawater to dropping as rain in a location to being incorporated in one of these proxies is very interesting. And it's not always as straightforward as certain published papers have made it sound. And then there's calibration. Dendrochronology has the distinction of having started a very rigorous calibration verification scheme against modern instrumental data. So we'll take tree ring records and we'll match them against 100 or 150 years of instrumental data, whether it's temperature or rainfall. And we'll use one half of the record to make a calibration and then predict the other half of the record and see how well we did. And then we swap it around and predict that. And we have a whole series of statistics that we use for doing this that tell us how strong our signal is. In other fields, speleothems have started to do this. Corals were the next that started to do this. So it's a very rigorous thing. It's very hard to pass these tests. And if you're reading a tree ring paper and they don't put this information in there, I'd be very skeptical of it because it means it's probably not significant. Reproducibility is the other thing. I defy you to take 10 stalagmites out of a cave and come out with exactly the same record. It's never happened. I mean, so this is something else we don't know. The stalagmite records are usually one formation. Now, there are some great stalagmites out there. And the criticism, again, it's the cherry-picking one that if anyone's ever had the stomach to read climateaudit.org, Steve McIntyre, it's very, actually, I do read it from time to time. I find it interesting. Because they do bring up some good points sometime. But this notion of cherry-picking your data, they ask, this is a question that we get asked all the time. Why did you not use these 10 chronologies, but you used these 10 chronologies? And that's something that we have to have an answer for. And it can't just be, well, it didn't agree with what I hoped it would be, so I threw them out. You know? There's reasons for it, and actually there are valid reasons for rejecting certain records. And the scientists know them, but we haven't done a very good job of explaining that. This is what I mean about opportunities, right? And then proxy comparisons. Can I take a tree ring record and compare it against the speleothem record? Well, I'm going to show you that we can. All right, so without, I know the last thing you want to see at this time is equations of something, but the oxygen isotope geochemistry is very interesting. I'm concentrating on this today because almost all these proxies, even though they use a variety of things, like tree rings, we use primarily the width of rings. I'm not going to talk about that today. We use the density. But we also can use carbon and oxygen isotopes. Ice cores use O18. The calcium carbonate in the speleothems or in the corals, they typically use O18. They can use strontium, other things. But this is the big one. And we use it because we have always taken it as a proxy for temperature. In other words, I'll go into this a little bit. The next slide will make it a little easier to see. But we compare the amount of O18 in a sample of water or a sample of cellulose in wood or sample of speleothem to the amount of O16 that's in there. So what do you know about O18 relative to O16? Heavier, right? And so that'll make sense in a minute here, why that's important. But, you know, you figure all the water that we have up in our column has been evaporated from the mean oceans primarily, right? So there's a base state in the oceans that we use, and we compare everything to that. So the mean volume of seawater, just so you know where these numbers, what they mean, and it's always expressed in the amount of O18 relative to the amount of O16. So in the sample and then in the standard, the seawater standard, right? And then this is roughly what the standard is, about one part of O18 relative to around 2,000 of O16. That's in seawater. And that'll change too, but we'll call that standard zero, and everything's measured from that. So what you end up with is readings of O18 in, let's say, rainwater that'll be anywhere from minus 20 to minus 50. So the more negative it is, the more light it is, the less O18 that's in that column of water relative to O16. And that is because as water evaporates off the ocean and travels through as vapor into the atmosphere and then rains out on the leeward side of the landscape, this is actually in the tropical scenario here, this is called the amount effect. So the heavier it rains, the more depleted it is in O18 relative to O16. So it becomes very light, right, if you make a measure of this. And what's interesting about this, if you look at a tropical storm or a hurricane, a typhoon, it's very, very astronomically depleted in O18. So it leaves a big signature in a proxy that picks up water from that period of time. And there was a really interesting tree ring paper by someone named Miller out of the University of Tennessee who did a reconstruction of hurricane events on the Atlantic coast by looking at big spikes in depleted O18 in the tree ring record. It doesn't work everywhere because trees grow in a particular season. They don't necessarily incorporate the water that's that light. So the rest of the year, you might have normal rainfall. They're not picking up that water. As you go farther along into the continent, the farther away from the ocean you go, the lighter it gets from the rainout effect, right? And so I'm putting this in your head here because I want you to see that it's not that straightforward. And Phil Jones published a paper in 92 in the Holocene that I thought was interesting. For years, the ice core people would just take it as a matter of fact that the O18 that they saw in the records was just a temperature proxy. For the colder the air mass, the less moisture you could hold in it, so the more depleted it would be. So the lighter, you'll see that in a minute. But what he showed was that in the Antarctic Peninsula, that was not true at all. So people had been taking ice cores along the Antarctic Peninsula, and this relationship didn't hold true. And so this is what Phil Jones is a tree ring person by training and a climatologist, so he started looking into this. It works sometimes beautifully, and sometimes it doesn't work. And that's because we can go, this is something that's been done, the global network of isotopes of precipitation. You can see there's hundreds of stations around the world where we've been measuring in a rainfall for several decades, right? And so I've been working a lot in Vietnam. The closest we have is Bangkok. And I'm not sure, that might be somewhere in southern China. But there are not that many stations in areas, but they've interpolated an isotope map that if I get this working, we can. All right, so here's an animation showing the weighted Delo-18 globally. It's for a year. It's averaged of all the years that we have data for. You can just watch what happens here. These are very light depleted values, and you can see that during the cold season, how depleted it is in the rainfall up in the Arctic, and how heavy you are in much of the tropics, because it's coming straight off the ocean. So you're heavier than you will be as you go inland. So there's these continentality effects that you get. Farther inland you'll go, you'll get these big bullseyes of blue where it's very depleted in 018. And so it's very useful to take this model and to be able to, you can actually go online with this and they have a little model. You can pick a site and an elevation and it'll tell you what to expect in the rainfall column for that period. It's very useful for calibrating against our paleo proxies. So this is something we didn't have 20 years ago, but we do have it now. All right, so the thing about ice cores, not to dwell on it too long, but one thing, it's real expensive. You know, you got to go to a place like Greenland or Antarctica. Just the costs are astronomical to do that. And then it's physically demanding and difficult. They drill way down. Now in Antarctica, Robin Bell and colleagues of mine at Lamont have gotten to the bedrock through the Antarctic sheet, the ice sheet. They've gotten down that far, and there's all sorts of cool stuff they've been finding out about what's going on at the base of these ice sheets, liquid water under all that ice. It's quite remarkable. But they pull out these big, long ice cores, and, of course, you have to be in clean suits, and they're freezing cold. You got to keep it cold. And then they'll check the geochemistry. Here's a close-up of one from a Greenland ice core that shows a period where it was a very dirty core down toward the bottom. But you see beautiful laminations in these, and you can see that they vary with density and so forth. So a lot of things we measure in them, but primarily it's oxygen-18. And here's an oxygen-18 record from Greenland that shows the time period from 25,000 years back to 50,000 years. You can see these big swings in Delo-18 that are interpreted as temperature records. All right, so temperature from a range of about 11 degrees C there. So that's interesting. And, these things actually do match up. But I wanted to point out again, a lot of these deep time records like the ice cores and the ocean muds, they very often don't have really good dating control on places. So they'll wiggle match them to match up peaks with peaks and valleys with valleys. And that can be a really dangerous thing. I'm going to show you a speleothem that was tuned to my tree ring record that made me cringe a little when I thought about that. I think the coolest thing about ice, about these big ice sheets, is that they trap air. And here's a great picture of showing one of the places in Antarctica, the Law Dome, has the highest accumulation rates of any of the parts of Australia. And it takes about 15 years to close air in trap bubbles. That's the fastest, that's the highest accumulation rates in Antarctica. And it produced the gas chromatograph lab in a CSIRO in Melbourne produced, they were really the top lab in the 90s. And they produced one of the most amazing records of CO2 through time looking at the Law Dome cores. And it took about a 15-year smoothing on that. So you have these beautiful records of CO2 showing how it's fluctuated through time. And here's a record. Here's one of the records right here. This one, I believe, is from Greenland. But what it's showing is that every time that CO2 got really low, we had cold events. This is going back 800,000 years from the present on the right. I apologize because a lot of my graphs are switched, right? And this one, the most recent time is on the right, and some of the other ones it's been on the left. I apologize for that. Different conventions in different groups. But what I want you to look at a couple of things. We never got above 300 except for here in some of these big warm events, these Dansgaard events. So you can see that this correlation between CO2 and temperature is something that is very interesting, and that we see this back in the time period. And we're already above this level. Now, the ocean cores is another thing that's extremely expensive. You get these big ships. It costs about $100,000 a day to run one, probably more now. My numbers are pretty outdated from when I worked with the Antarctic group. And they go out, and these big drilling rigs, and they drill in deep ocean, miles deep, and pull out these long cores. And this is the Geoides resolution and scientists preparing some of the samples from it. At Lamont Doherty, for anyone who's up there anytime soon, we have the world's largest collection of deep ocean cores that are archived. Have you seen them? Mm-hmm. Yeah. And who are you working with up at Lamont?
Sydney Hemming.
Oh, you're working with Sid. Okay, yeah. So we have this amazing archive up there, and Mo Ramo now runs this thing. Unfortunately, we're rebuilding the new core lab, but these are archived like a library, and people come from all over the world, and they take out a core. You can see here, half of them, when the cores are cut, half of them is archived. And so we have a collection, I believe it is the largest in the world, and these things are really amazing. And people still come and they say, we have a new technique using X-ray fluorescence, and we're going to run that on these and look at chemical assays on these cores. So there's an endless amount of stuff that can be done. Every once in a while, someone comes out with a new technique. We get a new record from cores that were taken back in the 60s. So it really is, it's quite the archive. Now, mostly what you're going to see from these, and not all, because there's a lot of suites of things that are measured, but mostly it's oxygen 18 or other isotopes. Deuterium is another one. That's a hydrogen. That's one proton and one neutron, 2H. But these are what are found in what are called foraminifera, and that's these little critters here. You can see this is 100 microns. So this is a scanning electron microscope image. But we know what these things, how they live. They're all different species, and we know something about them. So there's some that are called benthic and some that are pelagic. Do you know what those terms mean? There's some that float in the upper column of water. They live their whole life in there. And then when they die, they sink to the bottom, and they get incorporated into the mud. Then there's others that live along the bottom. So they're telling us about the temperature of the water, the geochemistry of the water at different depths. And when we know the species that we find, and we know them well now, people have grown them, and they know exactly where they're found, what they do. You can look at, they also give us a dating control because it's calcium carbonate in the shells. They just take it out of the seawater, and they fix the stable isotopes in their shells. So that's measured through time. So you get these beautiful deep time records from those. And without going into a lot of detail, here's some examples of some of these cores for the period of 7200 back to 9200 years BP, and showing some really significant events against the GISP-2 ice core from Antarctica. So you can compare these records. And very often when it comes to these things that aren't at the fine resolution as tree rings are, you're really picking up a smooth record that might be smooth by centuries. So these troughs and peaks line up with each other. But if you could look at them in higher resolution, which sometimes we go back and revisit these things, there's a lot of structure in those. So you're looking at a smooth record. That's another thing that I think you should have in your mind. So you don't expect every place on the planet to be doing the exact same thing. But in general terms, these broad features of climate can be matched up quite well. So speleothems is the other thing that I thought sounded so cool when I first heard about it. You know, this, again, was developed mainly by a guy from New Zealand, Chris Hendy, and he did a lot of the work with Wally Broker at Lamont. And so it goes back to the 60s, but it really got its heyday in the 90s. We started hearing about speleothems. And just to be clear on that, we're talking about stalagmites, the ones that grow on the bottom of the cave, not the ones on the top of the cave. That'll become clear why in a moment. I hope it becomes clear. Personally, I hate caves. They're creepy. I'm too big. I don't really like being in them at all. Bless you. So I'm not a big fan of doing this, but I think it's really cool to get these kind of records. This is in Dundak Cave in India, where a colleague of mine, Ashish Sin, has worked. I'm going to go through this fairly quickly, but if anyone's interested, if anyone wants this presentation, it's on this computer, so you can get a copy of it. But they form, of course, in areas where you get karst topography and you get limestone, right? And so when rain falls, and this is very dependent on a lot of things. Now, temperature becomes very important in developing speleothems, the amount of rainfall, where the rain's coming from. And I want you to think about what's called fractionation, evaporation and reworking of water as it goes through an environment alters the geochemistry of it quite profoundly. So if you have a cave, an opening here where you get these formations, the first thing you need to establish is that there's no exchange with the outside air. So one of the things we've done in Thailand is we've put loggers in the caves to measure temperature and relative humidity. And what we found in the caves we've looked at, there's very often a big seasonal change in relative humidity in the cave, which means you're going to get evaporation off the formation. It's altering the geochemistry. It's not an accurate reading. So that's not a good cave, necessarily. The good caves are those that isolate all this. So you have rain, and the CO2 in the soil and the limestone forms a weak acid that then goes through the calcium carbonate and drips through the water in solution, and then ultimately is deposited as a speleothem. And so the stalactites on the top of the cave are always evaporating as they drip. So you get a lot of exchange that makes them less desirable for looking at paleoclimate. It's the ones on the bottom of the cave. And these formations, just so you know, they're literally just taken. They knock them over with a sledgehammer, which means that that's it for them right there, and they take them out. So it's a destructive sampling technique, and you can never go back to that. But the other thing people have been doing is they're putting glass slides on the tops of drip formations, and for several years, you'll actually grow your speleothem to see what the accumulation rates are on that. And then we measure the geochemistry in the cave water. And there's a whole bunch of people going back to, as I said before, an opportunity if you're criticized. Let's go back and understand the fundamentals of it exactly, so that when I write a paper now on speleothems, I know exactly this is what I found in this cave and this is how it formed. Here's my error bars, and I have a lot more information. They have some advantages and some disadvantages. They're located throughout the world in terrestrial zones that have karst topography. They do contain information about rainfall variation or the source region of air masses, but they can as likely tell you about other exchanges with the atmosphere in and outside the cave, and that could be a signal that swamps anything that you're really looking for. They can be long and continuous, but they also can have a hiatus, which is a problem. You know, you don't know by looking at it, but there could be long hiatuses of thousands of years sometimes on these formations. And precisely dated using uranium thorium. But in the tropics, it's really hard to get enough uranium in some of these places to get really accurate dates. So their dating control isn't always great. But often they can have laminations that you can count, and they more or less match the real laminations. In monsoon areas, that's been the case. So we can get around some of those problems. And they can give you high temporal resolution to the annual thing. They're hard to work with. Here's what a typical formation looks like cut in half, and you can see these darker bands and aragonite in here. And, you know, some of this, you don't really want them to be dirty like that, because that's showing something, probably land use change or something above the cave is causing an issue. But they work through a variety of, there's a little Dremel taken through for periods, and that's not cocaine, that's actually ground up calcium carbonate. That's then run through the mass spectrometer and to get the numbers that we get on these. But I said before about comparing proxies. Here's a map showing a long triggering record I developed from Vietnam. That's the most tropical and well-produced, well-calibrated triggering record ever produced from the tropics, from Bi Duc Nui Ba National Park in Vietnam, where Charlene has been with me before. And then the Dunda Cave that I showed you in India by Ashish Sin. This is a paper that Ashish, and I'm one of the authors on it. And then the Wangshan Cave in China, which is probably one of the more famous, along with Hulu Cave, records of monsoon variability. And here they are lined up against each other, the Dunda Cave in Wangshan. And then these two periods here's against the Vietnam record. That's a very good proxy of monsoon rainfall. So you can compare these proxies. But here's the thing that bothered me about this when we published this paper. The dating control on the Dunda Cave was really not very good. He had very few points in his dating model, and he tuned his record to mine. It was off by a little bit, and he figured, well, this peak is probably there, and you know, so we matched it up. And that's a real cause for concern when we do things like that. And I don't know that it came across clearly in the paper that that's what was done, but that is what was done. And that's done quite often. And they're probably right, but I think that we gloss over these things sometime, and maybe we shouldn't. Transparency. And working with terrestrial sediment cores, this is what I believe you'll be doing this summer, and you're going to love doing this. You get muddy and you get filthy. This is Dorothy, as I showed. This is in Pyrmont Marsh. And you can work in open water. I've done this in the Arctic, where we've actually worked from an ice platform. So it's been frozen solid up in Labrador, and we drill through about 2 meters of ice and then drop these piston cores down and take the mud from the bottom of the lake. And all you do this all with a slurry of dry ice and denatured alcohol that goes to minus 70 degrees Celsius. And it's so cold that it's up there, you know, to freeze the cores to these devices. And then we take mud cores as well. It's pretty interesting. The most common thing, you can, like I showed the foraminifera, people can also use diatoms in any lake. or anything. And diatoms are another little creature. They're made of silica, and you can measure the stable isotopes in those as well. So that's something that's done. But more often, people use pollen. That's one of the common things to do in terrestrial things. And I wanted to put this in here because I thought this was a really cool paper by Dee Peterson and Dorothy and others, Tom Gilderson from Lawrence Livermore. But it shows from the Hudson River. Let me just show you where the map is. Here we are from areas right here up by Bear Mountain Bridge and also around Piermont Marsh. And it shows that there was very clearly a medieval warm period here that was very dry and full of fire. A lot of charcoal. And the pollen records show, here's the pollen records here. I don't expect you to be able to read that. But this is the way pollen records have always been plotted, and I've never liked it very much myself. So it's hard to really make much sense out of them unless you're a palynologist. But the species that we know, their ecology and what's been growing there, there's two major things that we find in the Hudson Valley. The change from the medieval warm period into the Little Ice Age, and then about the middle of the 18th century, the Europeans arrived and just totally altered every single aspect of the Hudson River. It's remarkable how much of an impact they had. Fire and the geochemistry, everything was altered completely. The introduction of new species like Phragmites, somebody was, I think you're working on that. So all of these things really had a big impact. And so using pollen, you can interpret the species with regards to climate shifts. But there's a lot of weird things about pollen, too, that I find kind of hard to work with sometime. All right. But it's a really cool thing, and it's another line of evidence to look at what's happened in the past. But I thought this paper just came out this week in GRL from Dorothy. I found it online. I didn't even know she had put this out. But they revolutionized or revised, really, the time of the ice sheet retreating from this part of the Wisconsin ice sheet. And just by looking at by the Laurentide ice sheet, so by looking at all these sites and dating them very accurately to the bottom, so when there was no vegetation, so when they were last covered by ice, and it's totally changed our idea by a few thousand years as to when exactly. Boring you? Okay. All right. So now we go, this is what I do. I work with trees, and I actually didn't put a lot of dendrochronology in here because I figured I was getting to the end of this, and you know, and I could talk about this stuff all day. But the cool thing about trees are, this is the oldest trees ever found. This is on Wheeler Peak in Nevada, the bristlecone pine you've heard of. And I don't know if any of you are familiar with the Prometheus tree. You ever heard that story? The oldest living thing ever found, a 5,000-year-old bristlecone pine that was cut down by a grad student in 1964. It's right around the corner from here. And the stump is still there. I didn't put the picture in, but I got a picture of the stump. And there's a lot of folklore that goes into that story. It's an interesting one. If you do a search on Prometheus tree, there's someone writing a book on it now. The guy's name was Curry, and he was out of UNC Chapel Hill. And he was a grad student at the time. And ostensibly, he was working on the Little Ice Age. So why he needed to cut down something that was that old, there's a lot of stories around it. It's unclear as to what it was. But one story has it that he got his increment core stuck in there, and he only had one. It was really remote in those days, so he asked permission to cut it down. And they knew it was old, but no one has ever found a tree older than this one. It had 4,900 rings in it, and the inner part of it was rotted, so they estimate it's at least 5,000 years old. And how would you like to be known as the guy who killed the oldest living tree? You know, and that haunted him his whole career. That really, everyone knew him for that. I think that was just, reminds me of a joke I once heard that I'm not going to tell. All right. But everything we do with dendrochronology is predicated on the annual growth ring, right? And now, so here's, again, the things that we know. And people question this all the time. There's a great creationist website. I forget what it's called. I wish I could remember. But they talk about how, because the Earth is only 6,000 years old or 4,000 years old, that the bristlecone pine must have been putting on exactly 7 or 8 year rings per year. And they had it all figured out. But we know that they're putting on one ring per year because I go back to trees that were cored by A.E. Douglas back in 1904. I core the same trees, and I can match them perfectly and account for every single ring. And so we can go back a century later, if the trees live that long, many centuries later, core the same exact trees again and match the records up. So everyone understands the idea of tree rings. That's what's kind of cool about it, is that everyone's seen a tree cut in their backyard, and they have at least some sense of what's going on that you can tell a story from them. Even Leonardo da Vinci had recognized that trees growing in the north part of the Mediterranean versus the south were reflecting differences in temperature or rainfall regime. So he recognized that at the time, wrote about it. He never cored any trees, to my knowledge. He probably just cut them down. But the one thing is, and this is a typical temperate conifer. I've been working in the tropics, so things are a lot more difficult than this scenario. But they'll have a definable boundary of some physical anatomical feature that'll tell me the ring has ended. And I can measure it exactly by under microscopy going and counting the number of cells. You can see them very distinctly when they stop. And then you get different things like what's called a false ring or an intra-annual band that are usually caused by an intermittent drought. I see them in Southeast Asia all the time, and they're telling me of monsoon breaks, a period when the monsoon has ceased for a couple of weeks, long enough that the tree begins to lignify in preparation of drought, of the annual drought, which lasts about 4 months, and then it starts growing again as the rains come back. So there's a lot of information we can get out of them. But the only thing that can control all the trees, if I go to, let's say I go up the Hudson Valley and I core 1,000 trees, 1,000 chestnut oak, they're all going to tell me the same story in general terms about narrow and wide rings. And the reason is because there's an external controlling factor that's climate. It's either going to be rainfall or temperature or some combination of those, but that's what's controlling whether the rings are wide or narrow relative to the ones around it. And we use that to be able to match up rings of trees that are dead, have been dead for thousands of years. Going back to the bristlecone, these bits of wood you see on the ground here, trees die and they stay there for thousands of years. So the bristlecone pine record goes back more than the Holocene. I think it's 11,000 years long now by piecing together stuff that we find dead on the ground. So that variability in climate enables us to match exactly these patterns and rings when it's done correctly. And I could point you to some bad tree ring papers that are in press. But because I'm talking about oxygen isotopes today, I wanted to put this rather ugly-looking slide up there because this is really, I find this to be really fascinating. As we're trying to go in to find new information of how we use dendrochronology, particularly to get at what I mentioned earlier about the medieval warm period, how do we know it's a period that was warm and not wet, or maybe some combination of both, the isotopes can actually tell us this. Because very often what they're responding to in the way they're incorporated into the alpha cellulose in the tree, the wood, is a complicated set of factors. But we can minimize the complication by sampling in the right locations where you don't have groundwater. Because what's happening here, the source water signal can get re-evaporated in the soil. And there's a lot of things that happen with fractionation. That'll change the relative DEL-018 to O16. But what happens is, all the trees respond the same way to it. So they tell the same story. It's just interpreting that story in terms of time. Climate can be a little bit muddied from all of these factors that take place. Fractionation inside and outside the leaf, because we have vapor pressure, changes between internal leaf pressure versus external leaf pressure, and the way they transpire through these little holes in the leaves that are called stomates or stomata. And so this is where the gas exchange here. This becomes more interesting, I believe, in conifers. And typically, tree ring papers are mostly conifer-based because they're so much simpler physiology than the broadleaf trees are, because they typically don't shed their leaves, so they retain their leaves for, bristlecone pine retain them for 30 years. So they have a memory, a persistence in the ring widths that we can trace back to how long it holds its foliage. Some pine trees, every year or two, they flush. They have much less of an autocorrelation in them when we look at the rings. But here's this internal leaf gradient between a conifer leaf and the outside air. So there's been a couple of things that have been interestingly hypothesized over the year. One was that trees growing at a higher elevation where the partial pressures of CO2 were less because you're higher up in the atmosphere, that would cause a fertilization effect in trees, a CO2 fertilization. Because the trees can now be a little stingier with water because they can close their stomates because they have so much carbon available to them, that partial pressure enables them to tighten up the holes in their tree to lose less water. And so there's a couple of different strategies that trees take. They either just open their stomates and go for broke, and then when they run out, instead of cavitating, they shut it down and they go dormant. or they get really stingy and close them down really little, exchange as little as possible. And that's what I'm interested in. So here's a close-up of a stomate on a pine leaf. And these guard cells here are what are triggered to open and close as the tree goes into stress. Right? So the isotope of interest here is not oxygen, it's carbon. And because C13 has a really couple of interesting things about it. And we can look at C13 relative to C12 in the tree species. Remember what I said about oxygen 18 versus oxygen 16? The O18 is heavier, so it tends to get spit out of rainwater. Well, the same principle is true with the internal leaf pressure in a conifer, so that C12 relative to C13, or C13 rather, will be spit out the stomates. In this case, the dark red are the C13. And normally, if the tree has opened up its stomates, it's just going to, it'll basically expel them during its transpiration, its respiration process, right? But when the trees go under drought stress, can you see that very well? Let me back up here. It's not very obvious here, but this is representing the stomates, the guard cells shutting it down. And so when that happens, now they shut down because they're under stress. And this is a way of just using, they have to use the carbon I'm done very soon. Use the carbon that's internal in the leaf for their processes. So they start preferentially eating up the C12, but ultimately they have no choice but to use C13, and that's trapped within the cellulose of the wood. That's a long way of saying that we can look at the relative abundance of C13 in the trees relative to C12 and know whether that medieval warm period was actually drought or wetness or temperature. And so if it's temperature driving that response in there, you're going to see a normal C12-C13 ratio. But if it's drought, we can say something about water use efficiency in the tree. So that's a really clever way of getting at that. Just for good measure, one more. All right, and I know I talked a long time. I apologize for that. But there are some really serious issues surrounding all this climate stuff. And I like this cartoon because it's sort of the way I look at it. There's a whole lot of reasons why we ought to do certain things because they make sense. I'm prone to air pollution problems, and I get really bad bronchitis every year when I'm in Asia. And that's a good reason to stop dumping so much stuff into the atmosphere, the health cost. And so when I frame this argument to people, I can't prove to them that we're warming the planet, but I can prove that we're polluting it. I can prove that our atmospheric chemistry has changed, and I can give you some pretty good evidence of what that's likely to do to us. And it's up to people to take home the message they want from that. But it's good to be armed with the knowledge of how these things work. Thank you, guys.